What's new from Apple? There's the new iPhone 16 Pro, built for Apple Intelligence. And it comes with the all-new camera control, giving you an easier way to quickly access your camera tools. The new Apple Watch Series 10 has our biggest display and our thinnest design ever. And this? It's the sound of active noise cancellation, now available on one of two new AirPods 4 models. So quiet. Check out all of the new products and new features at Apple.com. You can even buy yourself something new. See Apple.com for product availability updates. Apple Intelligence coming this fall.
But there's like this horrible flower bodysuit that she wears. It's one of the ugliest things I've ever seen.
It looks like she's wearing a skin-tight version of the upholstery on my grandmother's couch.
Yes, a cat suit version of that. Catwoman bodysuit version of your grandmother's couch.
And Marissa Tomei is incredibly attractive, but she is like a Goodfellas wife, where it's like, yeah, these are all attractive people with that zero taste. The more money they get, the worse their taste becomes.
Right, Goodfellas, exactly.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Bald Move Prestige. Today, we're talking about the 1992 legal comedy, My Cousin Vinny, which I'd never seen before. It's directed by Jonathan Lynn, which I was delighted to find out that he directed the comedy film Clue, as well as The Whole Nine Yards. I like both of those movies pretty well. It's written by Dale Lawner, who wrote Ruthless People, Blind Date, and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. I really like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It stars Joe Pesci, the man. Love him in Home Alone. He's also worked with Martin Scorsese on numerous occasions, including Casino, Goodfellas, Raging Bull, and The Irishman. Also stars Ralph Macchio from The Karate Kid, The Deuce on HBO. He's lately been on Cobra Kai on YouTube TV. The delightful Marissa Tomei, who also is in The Wrestler, The Big Short. She also plays May Parker in the MCU Spider-Man, as well as Mitchell Whitfield, who starred on Friends, Sergeant Bilko. He's also the voice of Donatello on the 2007 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. Fred Gwynn. I did not know this when I was watching it, but the Hollywood veteran came up in the television black and white era, Car 54, Where Are You? He was Herman Munster on The Munsters.
How could you not know that? Just look at the man.
Dude, I really didn't without the makeup and the bolts and the and everything.
That's incredible. Okay.
He's also in the Stephen King adaptation of Pet Sematary. Lane Smith, who was Perry White in Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
Sure, yes.
Yep. He played Major in Red Dawn. He was one of the evil coaches of the Mighty Ducks. He also got a Golden Globe for playing Richard Nixon in The Final Days. Bruce McGill also starred in The Insider, Ali, the Muhammad Ali biopic, as well as Collateral. And James Rebhorn. I've seen him in a lot of things. Carlito's Way, Sin of a Woman. He was on Homeland, but I know him as the CIA officer in Independence Day.
Oh, yeah.
I had never seen this film before, but its reputation had somewhat preceded me. I am a big fan of this YouTube lawyer called Legal Eagle, and he does a whole series of real lawyer reviews, fictional courtroom cases. He did Measure of a Man, the Star Trek The Next Generation episode,
nice,
where they debate the humanity of Data. He did my favorite who's that guy that the John Grisham novel adaptation, The Rainmaker, with Matt Damon and Danny DeVito. I had never seen this film before, but what I got from the Legal Eagle video is this is unironically considered one of the most accurate courtroom movies ever. It's like number three out of the top 25 legal movies as according to the American Bar Association. So I didn't know what to expect, and I walked away just delighted with this movie. I think the movie is funny throughout its entire length, but it has a fucking barn burner courtroom scenes. And apparently they're entirely realistic. And we can talk about that if we'd like. But first, I want to know, Jim, what's your experience with this movie? And what did you think, if you've seen it before and you've come back?
I don't know how this is possible, but somehow my teenage brain confuses this movie with Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag, which apparently no one has ever seen.
Yeah, I never heard of that. I was thinking, are you talking about like Four Weddings and a Funeral, or what? Seven
no,
Heads in a
Eight
Duffel
Heads
Bag?
In a Duffel what? Bag. It's Joe Pesci. He's apparently a gangster, you know, and he look. Joe Pesci plays a lot of gangsters. I can assure you that most of his performances kind of bleed together for me. These two movies are nothing alike, but I always confuse them. And so when we were covering it, I was like, oh yeah, that's the one about the duffel bag. And yeah, it's a big duffel bag with a bunch of heads in it. And he's got to get them back. But no, this is not that movie. So I kind of think I've seen this movie one time. I know I've seen it before, because I specifically remember him in courtrooms with Marissa Tomei, but I didn't really remember anything about it other than that. So this was kind of like a fresh watch for me. And I will say I was mostly pleasantly surprised, although I do think it has some strange tonal stuff in it. Like, this movie wants to be more than just a comedy. And I feel like that's maybe where it falls apart the most.
Really?
Because the comedy stuff is pretty good. It's like the scenes where there's pathos or like terror involved that I'm like, this just doesn't fit in here.
Yeah, I gotta say that, like, because the premise of this movie is Ralph Macchio and his friend who are driving from New York to California to go to law school or to go to college.
They're
driving cross country, and they decided to swing down through the South because the weather'd be nicer, the scenery'd be nicer, and they get falsely accused of a homicide, which is bad. And so, like, the specter of being electrocuted is dangled in front of these young men. But like the movie, you're right. The movie never actually feels like that. Feels like a really serious John Grisham type
that
novel.
That feels like a Time to Kill type shit, right?
Like Chris O'Connell's going to run out of the movie as the lights are flickering because he can't. You know, it's like, but right. No, it's not that serious. It's never that serious. And it doesn't
but then
ever
Joe
feel
Pesci,
that serious.
Like, when he gets on screen, he has some moments where his character really wants to grow, but he's feeling like he's not up to the challenge. And like, they play that for pathos and like,
yeah, and John Candy
genuine
freaks
sympathy,
out
and I'm just like, this is a comedy. Get that shit out of here.
John Candy questioned himself when he's coaching a Jamaican bobsledding team. I don't know if that counts as
right
pathos,
right.
But yes, it's definitely a character arc that the guy goes through.
Yeah, but then there are moments where the movie settles into like a serious tone that feels oddly strange. I don't know, given the rest of the tone of this movie, because a lot of it is sort of slapstick and just really over the top.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, this is the thing. This is not the kind of a movie that like wins awards, except wait a second. Academy Award winner Marissa Tomei won her Academy Award for this movie. Probably others do, but she won Best Supporting Actress or actor, actress.
I think she deserved it.
They split them up. It's a good performance, but it's a weird role to win for, I guess.
Huh? Yeah, because it's like it's not serious, you know.
It's not serious.
Tearjerker, it's not. But she's just so rock solid in this role, and so charming, and manifestly intelligent, and kind of offset some of the dumbassery on display from Joe Pesci. And you know,
but that's
Joe
what
Pesci
I mean.
Just gets,
you know,
yeah.
It's a comedy that is winning actors, supporting Oscars, and like. There's always a specter of the electric chair, which is not usually played for laughs, even.
True.
Sometimes.
Like, even they play the execution of a criminal.
Yeah.
As kind of a funny joke. Yeah.
And sometimes it's not funny in the movie. Sometimes it's terrifying. It's like, oh, the power goes out. And I guess maybe some people will find this funny, but to me, it was not played that way. I don't know. It's a weird tonal mashup that I found sort of detracted from what I wanted, I guess, which was the comedy of it, which is very good.
I, Like I said, I didn't bring any of that baggage into. I will say that, like, the first in the movie kind of confounded, because I thought it was going to be this fish out of water, big shot lawyer from Brooklyn, New York. And he comes to this podunk county in Alabama, and they've got a chip on their shoulder. He's got a chip on her shoulder, and he's a good lawyer. He's a slick lawyer, but he just doesn't play well down the good old boys of Alabama.
Sure.
No, this is a movie about a shit lawyer that has no business being in the case he does. And it's very similar. It's actually very similar to Rainmaker, except for Rainmaker goes way into the drama and the pathos. Mm. And it has got funny scenes in it, too. Like, again, Danny DeVito is hilarious in that movie. And there's a lot of really funny courtroom shenanigans, but it's obviously much darker and more dramatic. And this is just, I guess I never took seriously the fact that Ralph Macchio is going to be electrocuted at the end of this movie. In fact, I didn't even know Ralph Macchio was in it. Like, when they're kind of like long and the two kids are driving down the top down and they have sunglasses, I'm like, is that Will Wheaton with the tan? Is that that's fucking fair. Ralph Macchio. Holy shit.
Yeah, well, he's not the focal point of the movie, and probably for the better. Look, Ralph Macchio, I enjoy him in The Karate Kid. I enjoyed him in The Deuce. I think he's, like, grown as an actor, but in this phase, he's not an amazing actor. Let's not get it twisted.
He's The Karate Kid. Like, he's the exact same affect that he brings into that. Even looks like Daniel LaRusso.
There's always this the tongue-in-cheek feel with him where, like, is this guy, like, actually trying to act, or is he just brought in off the street to bop around a little bit? He was never the focal point of this movie. It's Marissa Tomei and it's Joe Pesci, and they are very good.
They're very good. I think Fred Gwynne, this is his last role. He died in the spring of the next year. And I didn't know he was Car 54, didn't know he was Herman Munster. Like, he is this very serious, sober judge, but he's also really sneaky funny. And his interplay with Joe Pesci, like, there's this routine where this what routine that they have throughout that's just such a good bit. And, you know, this guy who's, like, obviously a very serious judge, but he's also a little bit maybe slow on the uptake and a little bit kind of sleepy and... I thought the DA was really good as this kind of, like, blowhard, theatrical, crusading DA in a comedy film. Just everybody plays their part so well. That I was laughing throughout, and then the movie just keeps on picking up steam. Like, you know, you just think it's like, oh, this is gonna be a fucking disaster, and it goes places. Like, and again, the fact that this is considered one of the most legally accurate dramas of all time, any kind of movie, I'm not gonna have to qualify, but I guess Jonathan Lynn, the director, I just watched Clue a couple weeks ago. I love The Whole Nine Yards, really funny writer or really funny director. He has a law degree, and I guess he was really sweating the details. And if he thought something didn't stand up to legal scrutiny, he would get rid of it. There's only one scene that he didn't think was realistic, and he actually yanked it out of the screen. The movie. It's the moment where Joe Pesci meets his clients for the first time. And there's a bit of mistaken identity. But, like, on the cutting room, he's like, man, that scene is just so freaking funny that even though it's not realistic, I'm going to throw it back in.
Gotcha.
But other than that, everything else is, like, can and could plausibly happen in a legal situation. I guess they show this in law schools to show, like, how you can discredit an expert witness and how to direct examine an expert witness and how to cross. And I believe it because, nothing like, you know, you think about some of these things like A Few Good Men, which everyone is like a serious courtroom drama and investigation, but it hinges on just an insane piece of, like, Perry Mason courtroom bullshit.
Yeah, it's a great getting moment. A man to admit on the stand that he's a scumbag.
Yeah, yeah. And then just having nothing. Like, it's a fourth quarter in-the-game ass pull, desperation move. And there's that, but it's just...
Kind of. It's set up more than I think A Few Good Men is.
Yeah. Like, it's just, like I said, I think this, I was expecting a mid-90s comedy that's going to be a little eye-rolly. It's going to be offensive in some places, and it's
and
just
it maybe
good.
Is, but...
Maybe?
Yeah,
maybe.
There's a particular scene that we'll have to talk about, because you know, the actor himself has sort of discussed it in the ensuing years, and
yeah,
we'll talk about it when we get there. But yeah, for the most part, this holds up surprisingly well from a comedy aspect.
That's Austin Pendleton, who also, like, I love this guy in the 80s. You know, he was in Short Circuit. He was the director of the robotics program in Short Circuit. He's in the Muppet movies.
Huh.
He wasn't the dad in Alf, was he? There's no way. But yeah, he's the guy we're talking about. We'll probably talk about that later on. No, I guess not. I guess he wasn't. I wonder who the dad
looks
on Alf
like
was. He does. Anyway, I love this movie. I thought it's funny. It's like, it makes good use of the location and the cultural clash between the fast-talking, unconventional Brooklyn attorney and the Alabama legal system. I don't feel like it ever punches down to people from the South. Like, you know, it doesn't make them out to be like to completely corrupt assholes or whatever. It's pretty balanced. And the courtroom stuff is just, the back half of this movie is just a delight. It's like, gets a momentum around the halfway point in its runtime, and it just gets just keeps getting better and better and better. So I give it a big thumbs up. Huge recommendation. It's been a while since you've seen it, or if you've never seen it, you want to see some young, you know, kind of like Home Alone era Joe Pesci acting, not in a kid's film. That's the reason I never saw this. It came out when I was like, 13, and I was still very much in the thralls of my very conservative family. Didn't allow us to watch rated R movies. And it's one of those things where it's like, I never was in a hurry to, you know, watch this oddball courtroom drama Joe Pesci. So I this is a blind spot, and I somehow missed it on cable TV. It was
that's the thing. It was plastered everywhere on cable, apparently. Like, I was maybe a little too old to get that era of the cable stuff. I had moved on to like DVDs and just internet stuff at that time. But my wife, who was born in 89, says this is like one of the most watched movies of her childhood because it was just all over cable.
Yeah, I could see that. It was ironically on the hotel TV when we were down in Huntsville, and it's like, it's coming in like at the middle of the movie, and Ceci's like, "Oh, have you seen this movie?" I'm like, "No." She's like, "Oh, we should watch it." I'm like, "Actually, stop. I do not want to watch in the middle of a movie that we'd already knew that this was going to be a movie we're going to be covering, because we had the executive producers and the producers, right? This isn't a commission. This came out of that process.
Yeah, this was the last sort of slate that we picked that then commissioners got to vote on, producers and up got to vote on,
right? So yeah, we kind of stayed spoiler free. Do we want to get into the spoilers of the movie?
Yeah, let's do it.
This is streaming on, I believe, if you have AMC Plus or Hulu, it's on both of those. You can watch it for free, or it's widely available for $2.99. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
What's it like to trade crypto on Kraken? Let's say I'm in a state-of-the-art gym surrounded by powerful-looking machines. Do I head straight for the squat rack? I could, but this gym has options, like trainers, fitness pros, spotters to back me up. That's crypto on Kraken. Powerful crypto tools backed by 24/7 support and multi-layered security. Go to kraken.com and see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Cryptocurrency services are provided to U.S. and U.S. territory customers by Payward Interactive Inc., PWI, DBA Kraken. View PWI's disclosures at kraken.com/legal/disclosures.
And now, back with more Bald Move. Anyway, this is, as I said, it's called My Cousin Vinny, and it's about Ralph Macchio and his friend driving across country to go to college, and they go to a convenience store, and Ralph Macchio accidentally shoplifts a can of tuna, and he realizes as they're driving away, but they're like, eh, you know, whatever. And sure enough, they get police comes and pulls them over, and they think they're getting brought up on charges for stealing this can of tuna. Turns out, right after they left, the shopkeeper of this convenience store, the Suds and Go or whatever the hell it is, gets shot, gets brutally murdered by a person driving a mint green convertible. Same thing the boys are driving, and the cops bring them up. They're, you know, this is Alabama in the 90s. The death penalty is very much looming large for them, but they're broke college kids. They can't afford a high-powered attorney, but Ralph Macchio has his cousin Vinny.
Mm-hmm.
They get the name of the movie within 10 minutes of it rolling. And next thing you see, this big old Cadillac rolling into town with him wearing his cowboy boots and his leather jacket. And he's got Marissa Tomei as his fiance / paralegal. And the Alabama small county justice system is just ill prepared to deal with him as he is prepared to deal with it.
That's the thing, yeah.
And, you know, the whole debate is like, is this guy who barely has a law degree, has never actually been in a courtroom, is he going to be able to save his cousin from the death penalty? Guess you'll have to watch the movie to find out. It's really funny. Do you want to get into the nitty gritty of My Cousin Vinny?
Yeah. I love the statement, you'll have to watch to find out whether or not Ralph Macchio gets executed at the end of this film.
Mm-hmm.
As if this film would ever possibly end with him getting the electric chair. But yeah, it's more about how he gets mm-hmm. him off, right?
Yeah. There's some really... I mean, the setup, I think, is kind of funny. There's a lot of mistaken identity stuff. Like, it's really funny... Oh, yeah. I think that Ralph Macchio and his friend essentially confess, because the cops are just asking him, like, you know, did you do? Why did you do it? Like, what was your motivation? And mm-hmm. they're giving these answers that what a college kid's is like, can't really believe that they're being pressed this much on a can of tuna.
And they're appropriate answers for the level of severity of the crime they actually committed was accidentally shoplifting.
Yeah. Yeah. And but what
so
they're
like,
saying,
I didn't
is
really think about it.
incredibly incriminating from a murder accessory mm-hmm. to murder kind of perspective. And by the time they realize what trouble they've been, they've already made all these statements. And they even take, like, when Ralph Macchio finally finds out that you know, they want him for murder, he's like, I killed a guy. And they're reading that mm-hmm. into the record as a confession. And there's so many of those. Like, I think it's one of the scenes I said that he found very unrealistic, because they don't let attorneys, defenders, just into the jail cells, into the gin pop to, like, meet with their clients. But it's such a funny, you know, Joe Pesci comes rolling in this, like, you know, he's got like a St. Michael's medallion on, and he's got this leather jacket, and he's got his hair slicked back, and, Ralph Macchio, his cousin's asleep, and he's like, look how cute he is. Let's let him sleep. Well, let's you and I talk. And this guy thinks he's there to make him a sex slave.
Yeah, this is just after they had a conversation about that potential. You know what they do to guys in here, right? You have to become somebody's slave, and like,
if you want protection. Yeah. And then they walk him through gin pop, and they're all whistling because these are, you know, very pretty young men. And but both sides of that conversation work from this guy's like, well, I'm your lawyer and I'm just here to help you out, to ask questions. And he thinks he's
it's
there.
Your ass on the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or it's like, your ass, not mine.
Hey, look, you're getting fucked either way here. You should be grateful. You should be down on your knees. It's your ass. It's not mine. It's like, look, I didn't come down here to be jerked off. It's like, I'm not going to jerk you. It's really till, and it finds, like, you know what? Fuck you. I don't even care about you anymore. I'm going to go deal with this other guy. And he wakes up Ralph and he's like, Cousin Vinny. And I don't know. That stuff is really funny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's like one of the mistaken identities. I mean, the whole premise is a mistaken identity in the first place. And then you also have Joe Pesci purposely getting a mistaken identity during this film when he tries to bullshit his way into actually trying this case, because the judge is not inclined to even let him until he claims to be this big shot New York lawyer. As it goes by a different name at one point in the movie, and then, oh no, that's a mistaken name. I didn't say Gallo, I said Callow.
Yeah.
And, yeah, a lot of mistaken identity stuff.
And the judge, like, on three separate attempts, it comes out and he's like, I've got you. There's no lawyer registered as Vinny Gambini and the that's because there's this already when I got out of law school, there's already this guy practicing. He's a famous stage actor by Vinny Gambini. So it's like there's some professional confusion. So I went as James Gallo, and the judge is like flat footed, and he comes back later in the movie and it's like, I've got you now. There's never any I said Callow, and he just keeps on buying him a little time. I thought the interaction between I think Joe Pesci and the lawyer here, Fred Gwynne, now that I know who he is, it makes a lot of sense. But again, this judge is a little hard of hearing. He's got that really down south, syrupy, genteel accent. And, you know, Joe Pesci's using words he's never even heard before, can't understand. He's not dressed appropriately. There's a lot of gags about the crazy get-ups that Vinny keeps on showing up in court with.
Sure.
And I never got tired of the, you know, Pesci muttering something under his breath, and the judge is like, what? And Joe Pesci's like, what? And I don't know, that what routine is, I just never got tired of it.
Well, it's a good thing you don't get tired of jokes, because they do go back to the well several times on several different jokes. The most, I say egregious, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. I found it funny most of the time, and it kind of built on itself, but it's the things that kept him from getting a good night's sleep over the course of this movie. They play that joke like five or six times in the movie. Yeah. And ultimately I found it rolled back over too funny by the end for me. Because the first couple of times I did it, I'm like, okay, great. Yeah, this is a good joke. And then maybe the third, fourth time they did it, I'm like, they might be using this too much. But I don't know.
They kept on doing wrinkles on it. Like the second one with the train, I thought was a really good execution of like the Inspector Clouseau Pink Panther routine, where it's like, does your dog bite? No. Mm-hmm. He goes to pet a dog, bites him. It's like, I thought you said your dog does not bite. He's like, that's not my dog. And the thing about like, does there a train come ripping through this town every day at 5 a.m.? No, sir. That's highly unusual. Next night on clockwork, and he's like, nah, I thought you said, train usually comes through 10 past, or, you know, 10 after 4 or 4:10 or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. I thought that was just the vast array of ways you can be woken up in the dead of night in rural Alabama, trying to stay at the cheapest hotel you can. Because the judge, also the other thing is, the judge, every time he shows up to court, is found in contempt, and his poor fiance Marissa Tomei has to bail him out at the tune of $200. And
yeah, he's going to jail every other day,
and he's got to buy new suits. And yeah,
it's really good. I will say, I don't know how. I don't know. Does the waking him up play for a guy who lives in Brooklyn? Like, some of these things are very loud. I mean, when you're across from a steam whistle, it's very fucking loud.
Yeah.
A train going by that literally shakes your hotel, the bones of the hotel, is probably pretty loud. This guy's used to pretty loud sounds, though.
I think it reminds me like Pete Campbell said on Mad Men, you know, when he moved out of the city up into the burbs, and he's like, there's just no good nighttime sounds out here. And like, there are bugs and they're birds, but they're weird, and he only sleeps well under sirens and like street traffic. And,
right.
You know, when I was a kid, I grew up about 100 yards from a railroad track, and the coal shipment to the power and light station 10 miles down would rumble past, you know, the brr, brr, brr. Mm-hmm. And I always found that very comforting. Like if I'd wake up and I'd hear the train tracks rattle and the ding, ding, I always find that very relaxing. And there's that in this movie too, where like the hogs drove him crazy, the steam whistle drove him crazy, the train. But when he goes to sleep at the prison, there's the final joke where you think there's a prison riot and there's people screaming and yelling. But the Brooklyn guy's sleeping like a baby through all that, because that's like, okay, this is the kind of good nighttime noises I need.
Right.
I thought the turnabout of that was really funny.
Yeah, it was.
There's a lot, and there's also a lot of jokes that you think are just jokes, but they pay off. Like, I love the scene where Pesci and Tomei roll into this diner that they're going, you know, because they got woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And they give him the menu, and Marissa Tomei scans it. She's like, "So I guess breakfast?" And he's like, "Oh, you think?" And you're like, "Okay, well, of course you're going to eat breakfast at 6 in the morning." But then you see the menu, and it literally just says breakfast, $1.99, lunch, $2.45, dinner, $2.90. It's like, you just order breakfast, lunch, or dinner, man. And
eggs, bacon, and grits. That's it.
And the thing is the grits turns out to be an important part of the legal strategy by the end of the film.
Yeah, he didn't even know what grits were until he was served that breakfast, and then he used that later.
And the way he uses that little bit of knowledge to and the Southern pride to like, right. Now, sir, do you make instant grits? No self-respecting Southerner woods. Are you expecting it? He's like just hammering this guy on how it takes 20 minutes to soak the grit.
Just like, right, what does he say? I assume that the laws of physics just cease to exist on your stove.
Yeah. As he's trying to establish this timeline, and he keeps on saying, like, he thinks grits is the plural, so he keeps on referring to them as, like, individual grit. You soak a grit, and it takes that, it's I don't know, it's really funny.
No, I think that procedural stuff, actually, it makes a lot of sense, right? Because that is not, like... You know, you mentioned, does this movie make fun of sort of the South or that culture? And he's not using that in any kind of, you know, defamatory way. He's just using it to establish timing, right?
Yeah.
And then sort of appealing to the pride of the culture, like you said, that they would all know, that they would all just intuitively understand, oh, yeah, this man couldn't have made that in 5 minutes. There's no chance. I make grits at home every morning, right?
And you can see the whole courtroom. You get to see the, like, as they slowly turn on, and they're, like, turning on the witness. Like, what the fuck? You're making 5 minutes grits, boy? And,
There's also a really interesting moment with the jury where the prosecutor is up there delivering his opening statement, and...
Joe Pesci's opening statement.
Oh, yeah, Joe Pesci's, yeah. Everything he said is bullshit. But the prosecutor saying it, I think he makes a mistake here too, because, you know, with his maybe myopic view as a white man in the South, he refers to like everybody's English ancestors. And you can see there's a shot in there where they cut to the jury and like a third of them maybe are black, and they all go like, say what now? Our English ancestors?
What do you mean? Our,
Right. And so he doesn't come off looking great, even from the start, even though he isn't much better prepared. He is seemingly, I don't know, he's the better lawyer at the beginning of the movie, but he's making also a lot of mistakes. And I can't tell if he's making those mistakes because he just thinks he's dealing with a loser lawyer who can't put up a fight, or if this is sort of routine practice for him and he thinks he can get away with it.
Talking about
like these witnesses. I mean, he brings in witnesses who are wholly unqualified and easily having their testimony torn down by a guy who doesn't know procedure, really can only like go on a couple of things. Like they're nearsighted. They need glasses that they haven't updated in years. One of them lives behind bushes and trees that he couldn't have possibly seen from the angle that he was at.
And he hasn't cleaned his windows since the day he moved in 20 years ago. So,
yeah, even a cursory examination of these people and where they live would tell you, oh, there's no way their testimony can be accurate. or at least perceived to be accurate. So he's putting up witnesses that are maybe all he has, but just bad witnesses.
And I thought that too, because especially when he was talking about Voix, dear Dyer being this old English, and I'm like, what the fuck? This has got to be Latin. This is like a joke that this guy isn't as educated as he thinks he is. But no, it turns out that is, we get that term. It's the one thing that we don't get from Latin. It does come from English common law.
But he's also patronizing, or not even patronizing, he's infantilizing the jury in that moment too, right? And you're going to deliver a verdict. And do you know what verdict means? Verdict means guilty or not guilty. And it comes from this Latin phrase. He's playing it very patronizing, very infantilizing.
Before we move on, what's your position on grits? I'm not a fan. You're a city slicker. You're a California boy. I fucking knew it.
Yeah, not a fan. I had them a couple of times, and they're not the worst thing. I've definitely had worse foods, but it's a texture thing for me. Just not my texture.
I do love grits. We can get some decent grits in the Midwest, but they're only the Cracker Barrel. You can get them there reliably.
The themed
Waffle
country
House
stores.
But there's a couple things I always get when I go south. I gotta have sweet tea, because nobody in this fucking country knows how to make sweet tea unless you live in the south.
Sure.
I gotta have grits, and barbecue is another good one too. Because no matter where you go, grits seems like it's one of those quintessentially southern things, and I do. I think they're tasty. A little bit of sugar sprinkled on them. Love it.
I feel like they do take a shot at the South a little bit is that opening sequence where you've got the NYU boys driving from California. It feels like the coast taking a shot because they show all these signs. They show all this rundown stuff. They show all these signs that say like free dirt and free manure. And then they'll cut back to Ralph Macchio goes, look at that, you know?
Well, and his friend also, when he's having his meltdown in the police station, and he's like, these people are inbred. They sleep with their sisters.
Right.
You can't. But like, it's played as a shockingly offensive thing. Like the people in the room take offense. We kind of take offense. Like, come on. This is pretty.
And he's an idiot for saying this out loud in front of the people who are prosecuting him and the sheriffs who are 100%. Arresting him and holding him in cells. Yeah, he's an idiot in that scenario. But yeah, that opening sequence feels a little like it's taking a shot.
And there's a couple others. Like I think the yokels at the pool hall are kind of stereo. Like there's that one big fat dude that just sucks the meat off a chicken bone, which is really funny.
It is.
And you know, that these guys have like hustled, or no, Marissa Tomei successfully hustled these pool hall hustlers, but because she's a little woman, they just refuse to pay her. So Joe Pesci shows up and this is something they set up because he's and Joe Pesci is a little guy.
Oh, yeah.
And they make good use because like Fred Gwynn is like legit. I mean, he played Herman Munster. He's like 6'5" and Joe Pesci's like 5'5". And these other guys are much taller. When he's like, yeah, how about this? How about I kick your ass and I get my $200? And they're like, oh, OK. And you're like, well, where's this going to go? And then it becomes this thing where the yokel is trying to hustle him. He's like, oh, I don't got the money. It's not here. It's like, oh, you get the money and I'll kick your ass. And he shows up with a wad and he's like, how do I know that's not a 20 with ones around? Oh, it's $200. But it turns out that's exactly what he's done.
Yep.
And when he finally gets it's built up. This goes back and forth like five times where it's like as he meets these guys in the center of town, they're trying to like, are you ready to fight me now, big guy? And like, where that finally goes, where Joe Pesci fells this guy with one of the craziest punches I've ever seen.
It's like a tackle. It's like a flying diagonal tackle. I don't know.
It's
what
a combination like Little Mac uppercut from Mike Tyson's Punch Out plus flying off the ropes, clothesline tackle. And he somehow gets like at a 45 degree angle, just fully launches his body, and it just knocks this guy down. And Joe Pesci just grabs the money.
I love the escalation of that joke because at some point Joe Pesci has him so twisted up that he is begging to be able to pay this guy to fight him. Like,
yes.
And the sickness of it is that at any time he could simply stop pursuing this fight and he will have won. I mean, he wants to keep the $200 that he lost to Marissa Tomei. That's his goal. But over the course of the movie, his mind is so warped that he's trying to pay Joe Pesci to fight him.
Yeah. Cause like,
and there's
like,
no reason to.
Yeah, especially since like it comes off as like Joe Pesci backs this guy off, and I think his like pride's hurt, and his buddies are like, "You don't let that, you know, city slicker lawyer talk to you that way," and you kind of like putting him up to, is like, "We gotta kick this guy's ass. You can't let him talk to you like that." And, but yeah, this is another example of like, because I didn't think Joe Pesci could, even though Joe Pesci plays a lot of guys who've stomped motherfuckers out. In this movie, he's not that guy. Mm-hmm. But I guess he is. Just enough to catch this guy on a bad day with this crazy
that's
ass
the thing. Caught him on his worst day, right? Because I think that's the morning of the court thing where his suit's all muddy and he's hustling around trying to get to the court on time.
Right, right.
Yeah.
He just doesn't have time, but he's got the opportunity. There's also a lot of things like where, like, at the halfway point in this movie, I'm just like, with Ralph Macchio and his buddy, I'm just like, dude, take the fucking public defender. This is insane.
Of course.
What's happening here? And then you finally get the, because Ralph Macchio's like, I don't know, he's family. And it's like you're going to go to the electric chair because you're afraid to embarrass your cousin who's completely unqualified to try this case. And it's a capital case. So the other guy goes to the public defender and he shows up and he seems like he's super competent. And this is where I think this is the one controversial part of this movie.
Yeah.
You got this guy played by Austin Pendleton, and he seems like he's a good Southern lawyer, is going to be a good match to the other guy, but he's just got this terrible stutter and he cannot get a word out edgewise. And it's just a debacle. Understand. And you know the backstory behind this, right?
Austin Pendleton, he did this role and then later just came to regret it. He felt like it was sort of punching on down on people with either, you know, stutters or maybe some mental disability, something like that. And really wishes that he had not performed it.
Yeah, and he only did it for his friend Jonathan Lynn, the director, and I guess he did suffer from a pretty bad stutter as a child, and he found portraying that kind of personally triggering. And then it was such a successful role for him that he got typecast as a stutterer, and there's like a 7 to 10 year period of his career where he just kept turning things down because all they wanted to do is do that stupid stutter guy.
I mean, he's very good. Like, it's a very funny performance.
Yeah.
If you're reading it the way I was, because I was not reading it as this is a man with a stuttering problem, because every other scene you see him in, he's just talking normal, you know, the quote unquote normal. I viewed it as nerves, like extreme nerves. And so I wasn't finding it offensive.
Yeah.
But then again, I don't have the background that this guy has, and it's maybe giving it too much benefit of the doubt to say it's just nerves.
It's played for laughs, but not necessarily laughs at, like, I'm sure people do, this guy's stupid, but it's more of like, I felt bad.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know.
For everyone. Him, I felt bad for his clients. I felt bad for, the jury. Because, the tedium of trying to get through a case would be just rough.
I want to talk about Marissa Tomei because she's very charming and winsome in this movie. And there's a lot of things too that they set up where it's like, you know, there's a scene where, you know, Joe Pesci obviously has moments of doubt where he's afraid he's going to get his cousin killed and it's, you know, he's not good enough to do this. And
not played for comedy, by the way. This is like intense dramatic shit in the middle of this comedy movie. That's what I'm talking about with the tonal clashes.
And they had this way, like, he picks a fight with her about the leaky faucet. And she starts this incredible quotes about this, this torque wrench. And I applied them. This particular model takes between 12 and 17 pounds of torque. And I gave it the maximum allowable torqueage. And it's dead on balls accurate. And it turns into this, like, come on scene. And, you know, they've established that she was like grew up in her father's garage and she knows a little bit about cars. But it'll turn out in the testimony that wins the case that she's an automotive expert.
Yeah.
Like shockingly well informed about cars.
Like more so than the FBI's top guy.
Or the FBI guy's like freaking out because he's like, oh, my God, you're right. She's 100% right. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was like that's another example of like the grits where these things that they kind of play off as comedy, as just like, you know, this background detail of a character turns out to. And the fact that she's in the background taking cute pictures of him mm-hmm. the whole time, like these like seemingly unrelated things come together in a big way to save the case at the end.
Yeah. And that scene is more than just like a comedy scene or a dramatic scene or, you know, informing what's going to happen later in the movie. It also informs these characters. I felt like there was. You know, they're getting worked up because they're arguing with each other. And that's kind of what attracts them to each other. You know, and it's kind of almost a point of pride. Like, I think Ralph Macchio says something about like, yeah, you've seen your family argue, but you haven't seen a Gambini argue. Right. They raise it to an art. And then they go to that scene. And I think it's supposed to tell you that the reason these people like each other is because they're arguing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Just something fucked up I don't understand, but
and they do with some art and grace most of the time. Things get like there's like right at the turn of the last act, they get into a serious fight when it looks like it's going to ruin their relationship, and that's the low part of the movie where, you know, he fights back from that. But most of the time when they're arguing, it's like in that New Yorker kind of way where it's I don't know. It's just like fucking around with your friends, like you're insulting each other and all that. It's not taken too serious, and but it does. It establishes like that he is, and he's really sharp. Like Ralph Macchio talks about how he was able to like see through this magician's bullshit, and Joe Pesci kind of saves his case with a card trick that he plays on Ralph Macchio to explain. It doesn't mean anything, but he's bullshitting Ralph Macchio. But it turns out to be like he is really good defense because he's really good at finding the holes in other people's arguments. And
yes,
but it's also like he's just a terrible lawyer. Like he and that's another thing. They have this story that like this is kind of a tough hood from Brooklyn, and he gets in some legal trouble and he defends himself in like traffic court, and he the other Brooklyn come from nothing judge notices him and he's like, you know, I think you'd be a good litigator. I don't know what the fuck a litigator is, but he like, you know, kind of takes an interest in this like young man and him like, well, you know, this judge was a Brooklyn nobody and he's now a circuit judge or whatever. It's like, maybe I could try. And he does. He goes to some shit law school and he takes the bar 6 times and somehow doesn't know anything about trial law. He just wanted to be a personal injury attorney. There's a couple of funny scenes where you can see him try to do that, where he notices a guy in a bar wearing a neck brace and he's like, did you get hurt? Where'd you get hurt? In your property? And he's like, yeah, God damn. Okay, whatever.
Yep.
But he doesn't even know like discovery. I'm not sure why he does, but the district attorney invites him to go out hunting with him. And he's like, you know, oh, yeah, I'm gonna go hunting with this guy. It's got like men and I'm gonna finesse him and I'm going to get a look at his case files. And he doesn't know that under the laws, rules of discovery, you can just ask for those things. So he starts schmoozing the guy. And he's like, man, and he's a bad schmooze job. He goes from like step A and like step Z would be, give me a look at your case files. He goes from like A, B, Z. I really like to get it. And the guy's like, oh, like, let me call my legal assistant and have her make copies of everything. You can pick him up. And it just blows his mind. He thinks he's the greatest schmooze talker. And Marissa Tomei turns out to be kind of his paralegal, is reading the criminal code of Alabama. And she's like, you could just, it's called discovery, dickhead. And I thought that was really funny,
yeah,
too.
And that kind of follows on to another scene where he then takes that information about disclosure when the prosecution tries to call a new witness, but he has not had an opportunity to question that witness or been presented with their evidence. that witness is going to bring up. And so he goes to the judge in the next courtroom scene and says, yeah, under the law, I'm allowed this period of time in order to get acquainted with the new evidence witness. And the judge strikes it down. And that's, so this is, he overrules his objection. And I feel like that's got to be one of the areas where it wouldn't be accurate, where this judge is overreaching. And I'm sure that happens all the time. But he's such a stickler for procedure.
Yeah.
And he makes that point over and over, procedure. I'm going to be a stickler on this. But then when procedure is thrown back in his face, he overrules it in favor of his emotional dislike of this man.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they kind of take a shot, I guess, at this Southern judge.
Yeah, that he's got a personal agenda. But at that point, he thinks he's got this guy dead to rights, and he's waiting for this phone call from the New York Court of Clerks that's going to prove him wrong. And I did wonder, like, how the hell is he going to get out of this? But I thought the way it ended is pretty, but this judge thinks that this
satisfying.
guy, I think the idea is he overrules him because he thinks in like 2 hours he's going to kick this guy out of his court and be like, you know,
sure,
you're not even, hey, get out of my court, don't practice law in Alabama again. And he gets blown up on that. But there's a really some funny stuff. Like, we talked about the guy getting grilled over the grits, and you can start to see the court kind of getting behind Vinny. And then he's got Miss Riley, and he's establishing that she's essentially legally blind. I love the thing where she does this courtroom. Like, how many fingers am I holding up? And the judge, like, let the record show. And he's like, judge. And the judge is sheepishly. And I guess this was an ad lib where he goes, okay, Mrs. Riley and only Mrs. Riley, how many fingers am I holding up? And but I thought the low point of the movie's done really well, where he's frustrated by this judge overruling him for no reason. And he thinks he's got 90 minutes to win this case, or the judge is this sort of Damocles where he's going to find out that this fake lawyer doesn't exist in New York, and he's going to get blown up. And he goes out and he's got this one. He's like, hey, get all your film developed that you were doing shots, and maybe there'll be something. And he's going through it. He's just being an asshole about it. It's like, oh, here's the case winner.
Oh,
it's
me
stepping out of shower. Oh, this is going to turn.
This is really going to turn the tide. A dog shit.
Yeah.
Great. That's a great picture.
Just being an asshole to this woman who's been nothing but loyal and trying to help him, and she's just pissed, and she's like, that's it, I'm gonna make a phone call, I'm gonna get out of here. Then literally 30 seconds later, he realizes one of her pictures does make the case, and he needs her as an expert witness. And you hear about hostile witnesses all the time. But Marissa Tomei, coming off of this mega warhead argument, is one of the most hostile witnesses I've ever seen.
Oh,
and
it's
really funny.
Here's my only question where I don't know that the ending of this hangs together. How does Joe Pesci realize that there's a discrepancy in this photo? Because he almost has to have the same level of knowledge that she does in order to even realize that this photo is valuable in the first place.
Oh, yeah. They established the whole time he was in law school, and for the 6 years he's trying to take the bar, he worked. That's how they met. He worked in her father's mechanic shop. He was
so
a mechanic.
He is an expert. Okay.
Yeah. But obviously he can't put himself on the stand, and she's better than him.
Yeah. What value would that have?
So he
realized. Why couldn't he cross examine? Yeah. I guess he's calling his own expert. He could cross examine. Or I guess the other guy's already been called, the FBI. Forensics guy.
Yeah, and there might also be like, there's rules. I know this because I dated a law student once upon a time, and I helped her like in her third year, like, you know, kind of prepare for some stuff. But there's a lot of really weird shit in the legal system. Like, when you're on direct exam, there's a lot different rules than when you're on cross exam. And
gotcha.
I think it might be like he's allowed a lot more freedom and asking her open-ended questions, like explain the significance of this, where he wouldn't be able to do it on cross. But also shows there's also like, now that I was thinking about this after the movie was over, but even when she hated this guy, the implication that she also launched the plan that saved him, like the reason she was on the phone wasn't she's trying to arrange transportation home, but she was trying to get the pulled a string with the friendly judge that would lean on the clerk of courts to lie to this judge in Alabama about the Jimmy Callow's qualifications, or Jerry Callow rather. But yeah, and then man, I really thoroughly enjoyed Vinny's like victory lap around the court as he realizes he's winning and he starts like showboating in front of the judge, and he goes by the jury, and he's just knows he's got this guy by the ball, the other guys by the balls. And
I mean, it's a three pronged attack, right? I mean, he's going to get Marissa Tomei up there to just lay out the case for why this car might not be the same car. He's going to get the FBI guy to basically confirm, yeah, that's true. He's going to then get an identification on two other people matching the same description with the same car description who were arrested with the murder weapon.
Which is the one thing, like, the DA said, that's the only thing I don't got.
I wish I had it.
The only thing that would be worse for your guys is if I had the murder weapon. And I thought when he called him to let him know I got a bomb for you tomorrow that they were going to find a murder weapon. But that's the other thing that's interesting about this movie. Like, most legal thrillers, there's a little bit of like doubt about what the truth is. But we were along for the ride. Yeah. We know that they weren't even close to any kind of gunplay. And a lot of the stuff that where they're talking about these guys pull out of there and fishtailed, well, they didn't do any of that shit. So we knew I'm thinking, how can the murder weapon help? Because Ralph, there's never going to be fingerprints on it. But it turns out it's this expert rubber FBI tire analysis.
But then it turns out
the murder weapon totally vindicated him, because it's like they found the guy with the exact car that Marissa Tomei thought, and they were pulled over. They found the 357, same caliber. And it's as satisfying as any legal thriller I've ever seen, but it's also really funny. And, you know, usually it's like this jaw dropping, gasping moment, but like everyone in the court is having fun. Like by this time, like Vinny has completely won everyone in the courtroom over, from the stenographer down to the people in the galley. The jury's eating it up.
And I love it because it gives you a glimpse into what he did that impressed that lawyer. Or judge. Right. No, the judge back in that other court case, right?
Yeah. Because he made the cop that was trying to hang a ticket on him look like an idiot. He just was spinning around with all these questions, and it's good. And I like Marissa Tomei, just something intrinsically funny about her delivering all this super hard-boiled mechanical. Like, I know my way a little bit about an engine and transmission, but she's like talking about how many degrees from top dead center a timing is, and the posit traction and an independent suspension axle, and it's good.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Whether you're working out or working on your high score, you never settle for less. So why should it be any different when you choose your protein drink? Rockin' Protein comes in three delicious flavors, has 30 grams of protein, and is always made with fresh milk, so you're never left with that chalky taste. Rockin' Protein. Never settle for less than a great-tasting, high-quality protein drink. Visit rockinprotein.com to find Rockin' Protein wherever you are. Rockin' Protein and Shamrock Farms are registered trademarks of Shamrock Foods Company.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. Sell order assessment fee not included. A limited number of ETFs are subject to a transaction-based service fee of $100. See full list at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Pro FinSimple offers flexible financing solutions for all kinds of businesses, whether you're an electrician or run an organic farm. Because we know that your business demands financing that works when you need it, like when your landscaping company lands a new account. Wherever you see your business headed, Ford Pro FinSimple can help you pursue it with financing solutions today. Get started at FordPro.com/financing.
And now, back with more Bald Move. Boy, they both have their share of outfits in this movie, huh? From Joe Pesci's, you know, he starts off in, I don't know, it has a certain look to it. You can tell he's a certain type of guy. He's got this big leather jacket. He's got these cowboy boots with the metal tips. Yeah. He's got chains and necklaces. Yeah.
It's like John Travolta from Grease left the mechanic shop and got a law degree. That's how he walks into the courtroom.
But that's not how he leaves the courtroom. He leaves the courtroom in this fucking zoot suit thing that is hilarious. It's like a lounge singer's suit from the 1960s, right?
Yeah.
That he has to get from a secondhand store because his suit gets mud all over it, and this little town doesn't have a 1 hour cleaner, and the suit shop that he normally would get a nice suit from is closed because everybody in the store got the flu because there's probably one person working there.
Right.
Yeah, and so he ends up in this horrible thing. Marissa Tomei has her share of bad outfits too. I will say I think she wears them better than Pesci does. But there's like this horrible flower bodysuit that she wears. It's one of the ugliest things I've ever seen.
It looks like she's wearing a skin tight version of the upholstery on my grandmother's couch.
Yes, a cat suit version of that, Catwoman bodysuit version of your grandmother's couch.
And it's also weirdly camouflaged in the environment.
Okay.
Because it is this kind of floral, autumnal, you know, couch pattern, and they're out in this cabin, this hunting cabin, and it's like everything, she kind of like disappears into it.
That's horrible. And her hair is all blown out, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's as huge as they can make it, yeah.
I mean, Marissa Tomei is incredibly attractive, but she is a Goodfellas wife, where it's like, yeah, these are all attractive people that have zero taste. The more money they get, the worse their taste becomes.
Right. Goodfellas, exactly.
Yeah. And there's even like, did you know that this was supposed to be a series? Like, this was going to be like a Gambini investigation. It's like there's going to be a series of Joe Pesci and Marissa Tomei going to different places and essentially winning cases like this. And I guess there was a problem where they couldn't get Marissa Tomei back for so long that the idea kind of fizzled. And they kind of set that up at the end of the movie where Joe Pesci's like, even though he won his first case and theoretically now they can get married, he's kind of butthurt because like, I just want to win my first case without any help. And the judge that was my benefactor helped me out and you helped me out. And she's like, oh my God, what a fucking nightmare it would be if you just won every one of your cases with the help of your friends and people around you. And I think that was supposed to be the kickoff of like, what if this is your career and they're going to do like a whole series of them. But it's a solid idea. It's essentially the same thing as within different scales, like Knives Out, you know?
I mean, it's like Matlock or Perry Mason or any of those, right?
Yeah. It'd be pretty fun. It'd actually be a really fun, like, situational type comedy, you know, where it's like it's kind of like LA Law or Law and Order or Boston Legal, but it's just completely, it's funny, but it's like well grounded in law. That's the thing. Like, I don't know how many times they could do this kind of legal magic where it's like,
yeah,
dead on balls accurate from a legal perspective, but believable that this guy could do. Plus he should become a better lawyer, so like the
right,
you know, it's like you couldn't do the Rainmaker too, because like, well, Matt Damon made his bones in this movie, so like it's not going to be shocking if he keeps winning cases because he's a really good lawyer, it turns out. He just was inexperienced. So but yeah,
the one I would like to see them do is I would like to see a mirror match, him versus the other New York slick lawyer, right? I'd love to see that.
Oh, I thought you meant like a Southern boy and a Southern lawyer in New York.
Oh, no. Yeah, the mirror universe kind of version of this.
Mm-hmm.
that could be fun too. But yeah, mostly.
Like a whole Brooklyn court where everybody's talking in this like, I'm walking here kind of accent.
Yeah, I'm litigating here.
I'm approaching the bench here, Yana. There's so many funny things, like when he's held in contempt for the way he looks, and he's like, you better come into my court the next time more lawyerly. And so he comes in with like a silly tie, but the exact same outfit, And the judge is like, I thought I told you to be more presentable next time. He's like, oh, you were serious about that? And then smash cut to him taking the bus to the county jail for his contip thing. And
that was good. Yeah, a lot of good gags.
I was delighted. Yeah, and the way the prison thing where he's like, you know what, just leave me in here. I want to get a good night's sleep. And
I will say there is one thing. I was delighted during the movie with the comedy of it all. And I thought once the movie was over, all right, that was delightful. But there was something delightful I found after the movie ended. Did you know that after this movie was made, Joe Pesci, who apparently was a lounge singer before he turned actor?
Did not know that, but it checks out.
Yeah.
You can see it, right?
I could see it, yeah. Especially after actually seeing it. Apparently after this movie, he made an album. He cut an album based on this character, Vincent LaGuardia Gambini, where he does a lot of things. I mean, he does some lounge singing for sure. He also does a rap, and it's all like as this character or themed around this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this was his like big triumphant return to lounge type singing,
and it's good. Like it's kind of Weird Al in that it's very profane because he's just throwing, you know, fuck here and there, but it's like he's got, like I said, you can see it. You can see, I can see showing up to a dive bar and him being behind the piano, you know, belting out this stuff. You could see
And it's identifiably Joe Pesci. Like, he doesn't 100%. Have a singing voice and an acting voice. He just has Joe Pesci voice.
Right.
He's not a great rapper, I'll say that. It reminds me a lot of the, you know, very forced for a TV show or movie, like promotional raps that were happening in the 90s, like the
rap, or like when your school principal would improvise a rap about not smoking.
Yes, absolutely. A rap you would hear in a high school gymnasium.
My name's Mr. Wallace, and I'm here to say no to cigarettes every day. Yeah, it's that kind of shit.
It is, but he said if it's say no to cigarettes every fucking day, that's rap that he'd be doing, yeah.
I'm Mr. fucking Wallace and I'm here. Yeah.
It's worth a listen. Go, search for Vincent LaGuardia Gambini. Sings to You? Is that the name of it? Or Sings Just For You?
Just For You. That's right.
Yeah.
Just that up on YouTube. Just For Me. Just For Me.
Just For You.
Yeah. There's interesting casting notes because apparently this was written as a vehicle for Andrew Dice Clay, who was this.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
If you're a Gen X older millennial, know he was this very controversial comic that his whole thing is misogyny, homophobia, and X-rated nursery rhymes like Hickory Dickory Dock, Miss Tuffet sucked on my cock, hey yo. And he would, he had this cigarette, and he's just a disgusting guy. And he had, I guess, an early version of canceling happen to him as this was getting together. And so now this studio's got this vehicle that's supposed to be for this loudmouth, profane, very New York, very Jersey kind of Guido guy. And they were trying to get Danny DeVito, Peter Falk, Robert De Niro. I guess Jim Belushi really kicks himself for not doing this film. And Joe Pesci, who had done stuff like, you know, Goodfellas, but he hadn't done any commercially successful things yet. This was his first big hit movie.
Really?
Yeah. Like, this is like, you think about all the other stuff he'd done where, you know, like Raging Bull, like those were, you know, those are serious fucking movies, but they don't make tons of money at the box office. This thing made a ton of money, on home video, became like this cult club. Cause like, this is like a lightly regarded film at its time. It got good, but not glowing reviews, but it just, as I think lawyers really love this movie, and kids growing up at home where they were seeing the, you know, Comedy Central version with the F's bleeped out and start liking this movie. And it's really entertaining, and it's a feel good story.
There's a lot of people I could see in this role, but Joe Pesci really brings something extra to it.
The other thing about that guess you mentioned about Vincent LaGuardia, Marissa Tomei's character is Mona Lisa.
Right. Right.
But they wanted the Lorraine Bracco, who's the therapist off she's Henry's wife off The Goodfellas, and she's also the therapist for the Soprano, Tony Soprano. And she would have killed it, I have no doubt.
Oh yeah.
But it's hard to see anyone else but Marissa Tomei in this movie because she just crushes it.
Mm-hmm.
And even like does it feel like there's a huge age difference between Joe Pesci and Marissa Tomei in this movie?
A bit, yeah. Yeah, you can see it. I feel like Joe Pesci's had a facelift at this point.
And oh, really?
Marissa Tomei is still pretty fresh-faced, so...
Yeah, because she's... Like, how old do you think they both are in this movie? Because I
would guess she's 26 and he's 45.
Ben, you almost bang on. It's like 25-45, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
But I will say it didn't feel like a 20-year age gap. I feel like, you know, maybe he's 5 years older than her because he's out of college, you know. But yeah, I was like, I was impressed at how she looked older than she actually is, probably because of the makeup and the hair and all that stuff. And he looks younger than he actually is. You know, he's probably got a full toupee. He's got
because of the makeup and the hair and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I don't got much more to say about this film
other than
I was just pleasantly surprised. I was expecting a good but aged movie. And I was just had a great time watching. I had a big smile on my face after it's over.
I expected a giant duffel bag full of 8 heads. So I was pleasantly surprised, too.
There you go. There you go. I mean, obviously he's guilty of that. I don't know who can show up with a... licit use of heads and duffel bags, but I don't know if anyone could. I guess it's Joe Pesci. That's going to do it for our coverage of My Cousin Vinny. Hope you've enjoyed it. Maybe you can take a look at it this weekend. Get the family together and revisit this comedy classic from the 90s. Yeah, we got a bunch of really fun prestige movies coming up. We've got a new system. Previously, Jim and I would select a slate of 3 movies, usually from the same year, and we'd present it to our executive producers. They'd vote on it. We've now got it to where executive producers can just nominate films, and then we give it to the producers to kind of vote, and that's the system that we're using going forward. So. If you're a club member and you're in the executive producer, check out your emails and your alerts you're getting because you can shape our prestige coverage. And we're looking forward to having Severance back. I think that's early in the year. It's like January, middle of January of 2025. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to be maybe there's another one that I'm not thinking of, but I know that's going to be a prestige TV that we're excited to get back to. And we're going to release full coverage of season 1 to lead up to it. And that'll start coming out probably early November, mid November to kind of coincide. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So got that to look forward to a couple months ahead. Thank you for listening. Really appreciate it. We'll see you on another, prestige podcast real soon. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Keep the mud out of your tires.
Every time I get the urge to visit my hometown, I'm sure that all my cousins will try to track me down. My heart says go, my head says no, it's best to stay away. But if I appear, I'm sure to hear all those jerk-offs say,
hey, Cousin Vinny, your Cousin Vinny, is there anything that you could do for me? Hey, Cousin Vinny, your Cousin Vinny, it ain't that long, you must remember me. Hey, Cousin Vinny, your Cousin Vinny, is there anything that you could do for me? Hey, Cousin Vinny, your Cousin Vinny, hey, we're your cousins, we're your family.